every Thursday, we like to have someone who is liberty-oriented, and we like to have them come on the show and talk about life from a liberty-oriented perspective. And today is no different. Today, we have Mark Thornton on with us. He is a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And if you haven't checked out the Mises Institute, go to Mises.org to check it out. It's fantastic. They have great stuff there. They have lots of videos that you can watch and lectures that you can watch, and they have lots of books for sale. I actually just went, I think yesterday or maybe the day before that, and ordered something like 12 books from Mises. So it's worth checking out. Mark is the book review editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. He served as the editor of the Austrian Economics Newsletter and as a member of the editorial board of the Journal of Libertarian Studies. He has served as a member of the graduate faculties of Auburn University and Columbus State University. He's also taught economics at Auburn University at Montgomery and Trinity University in Texas. Mark served as assistant superintendent of banking and economic advisor to Governor Fob James of Alabama, and he was awarded the University Research Award at Columbus State University in 2002. His publications include The Economics of Prohibition, Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Economics of Civil War, The Quotable Mises, The Bastiat Collection, and An Essay on Economic Theory. He is a graduate of St. Bonaventure University and received his PhD in economics from Auburn University. And Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining me this evening. I really appreciate it. And I have to tell everyone, we were emailing each other about what we were going to talk about. And you sent me this email and you started talking about skyscrapers. And I was like, what? And so I started reading this article that you had sent me talking about skyscrapers, and it was like this wake up call in my head, right? This just snap to awake. Holy crap, that makes so much sense. And I mentioned it to my producer, and I mentioned the word skyscraper, and he said, yeah, the skyscraper index. And I was like, you've heard of this thing? And he said, everyone's heard about this thing. What, you know, what rock have you been living under? What kind of idiot are you? How could you not know about this thing? And I said, well, I guess I'm about to find out more about it right now. I'm going to find out about it because it all just makes so much sense. But since I never actually studied economics, there's a lot of things that I've missed. So, Mark, what is the skyscraper index?
Well, first of all, Angel, it's so great to be on the program. We've been trying to make this happen for so long, and I'm just so happy that we're finally on the air together. And the article that I sent you is something that's going to be coming out on Mises.org. That's Mises.org on Saturday, I believe. And it's something I just whipped up with respect to the naming of One World Trade Center in New York City, the tallest structure in the United States, that was recently done by the Council on Tall Buildings. They get to decide these things. And so,
wait, there's a Council on Tall Buildings?
Yes, actually, the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. It's kind of a private regulatory body that issues awards and is the final arbiter of who's taller than who, and you know, that kind of thing.
So it's like the Guinness Book, but for tall buildings.
That's right, absolutely, and so they made their call this past week, naming the New York building the tallest, even though 408 feet of it is just a spire on top of it, so that it actually gets up to a height of 1,776, you know, in recognition of our year of independence.
Oh, yes.
And it replaced the World Trade Tower. So I think the council felt pressure to, you know, give the award, at least temporarily, to this New York structure. But the skyscraper curse is, whenever there's a new world's record or national record or continental record for skyscraper height, that is an indicator that you're going to see an economic crisis. So it's kind of this eerie correlation that over the last more than 100 years, every time there's a new record set, the economy goes down the tubes. And frankly, this time it's happening in New York. And I think that it very well could be, you know, a very large economic crisis, given what they've been doing at the central bank, at the Federal Reserve, because ultimately these booms and these bubbles are all generated at the central bank by people like Ben Bernanke and soon to be Professor Janet Yellen. That's the source of these problems. It's not the actual building that causes economic crisis. It's just that the building of these super tall structures is just a symbol of the boom bubble times that we're living in.
So it's not that there's a problem with building a huge building. It's not that there's a problem with that. It's that historically, when you go back and you look in history, whenever some area builds one of these gigantic buildings, they're on the verge of collapse.
That's correct. Take, for example, the building of the Burj Khalifa Tower in the in Dubai, in the United Arab Emirates. It's the current world record holder right now. And in August of 2007, it reached the height of the current record-setting tower in Asia. And so I issued an alert that this was a sign of a looming economic crisis. And, of course, by the end of the fall, in the winter of 2007-2008, the housing bubble was coming unraveled. Mortgage financing companies were going out of business. Banks were contracting. Unemployment was rising. The Fed was responding with lower interest rates. And, of course, that whole thing just evolved into the world economic crisis that we're frankly still in. And when the building finally was completed and it went up really super high and it was finally open to the public in early January of 2010, the company that built it was bankrupt. The nation where it was built was bankrupt. And, of course, the world was in the depths of the world economic crisis. So that's the way the story goes, and that's the way it's been going now for over 100 years. It's just that when the central bank lowers the interest rate so low and makes every project out there look like it's going to be profitable, then people start doing a lot of investing and producing huge projects of various sorts. It's not just buildings, but it's factories, everything, building huge houses, building huge corporate headquarters, building huge and expensive sports stadiums. And so it's just the skyscraper that is the indicator of what's really going on here. That's what stands out, no pun intended, but the effects of the central bank policy on low interest rates and artificial credit is causing changes throughout the entire economy. So that's the relationship. It's a sort of a coincidental indicator. It doesn't mean that the actual building itself is responsible for example, the housing bubble. It's just that they're all part of the same process that's generated at the central bank and easy money or easy credit policies.
Okay. So now what we're going to have to do in just a moment is we're going to have to step away. And when we return, what I would like to do is I would like to find out how you initially made this connection, because as you said, it's not the big buildings, it's not the skyscrapers that are causing these crashes and these collapses and these ends of the cycles or the next stage of the cycle. But I really want to know how you made this connection, because it's just it does absolutely make sense. Right now we're talking about something called the skyscraper index, which I just learned about today. And in fact, it was about an hour and a half before the show started, and my jaw just kind of dropped. And I said, wow, you know what? This makes so much sense. I really need to start reading more books. I need to start reading more books. Get back to the reading, right? Less science fiction and more reality. But Mark is here to actually talk to us and explain the skyscraper index, because, well, I need to learn things. So, Mark, I want to thank you for sticking around. And you've explained a little bit about how these huge buildings appear in society, and then shortly afterwards, there's this economic collapse. And it all makes a lot of sense. But how did you originally make the connection that this was happening?
Yeah, well, Angel, you don't have to read an entire book. Like I said, my article is coming out probably on Saturday, and it's less than 1,000 words. And that's what the Mises Daily article is all about. It's cutting-edge stuff, less than 1,000 words, important stuff that you can't get elsewhere in the media, just like your show. People need to be going to your show because you're providing an alternative to the mainstream media, which is, you know, just blabbering the establishment line on so many things. But I came across the Skyscraper Index. I've got a report from an economist in Asia named Andrew Lawrence, and he was a real estate analyst, and he put out this little report called the Skyscraper Index back in 1999. And the mainstream business media kind of made fun of him, you know, comparing this to the Santa Claus rally, the January effect, and other stock market type coincidental things. Is it the NFC or AFC team that wins the Super Bowl? And all those are sort of nonsensical. There's no connection. But I immediately saw the Austrian theory of the business cycle in his Skyscraper Index. I saw a rationale for connecting one to the other. And so I started doing research, and I started writing this article, looking at the real estate economics. And basically what I found was that building the world's tallest skyscraper doesn't typically make any economic sense, because you've got to come up with new ventilation systems, new elevator systems. You've got to come up with new heating systems, because you've got to pump that heat, pump that water, and the trash and everything has to go up so high and then back down that you've got to come up with new stuff. And so it doesn't make sense to go that high. It only makes sense to go to whatever the current height is. That's more economical. But when the Fed gets in the business of lowering interest rates, that changes everything because, well, for example, in real estate, they'll tell you that lower interest rates drives up the price of land, and it drives up the price of housing and any kind of buildings. It just drives up the value naturally, just as it tends to drive up the value of stocks. So when the interest rates come down, especially if they're below what the market would charge, that encourages people to conserve on land and to build higher. And so, you know, that's the primary economic connection. And then there's also this notion that if the Fed lowers interest rates, everybody starts investing, everybody thinks they're making huge profits, and so they're being more and more speculative, they're being more and more, you know, consuming and investing and building, and everything's going right. And so it just seems to make sense that, well, why can't I build the world's tallest skyscraper and call it the Mark Thornton skyscraper, you know, 300 stories high or whatever. And so that's the sort of climate that, and the sort of economics that I was able to add into the coincidental sort of incidental connection of the dates of the building of these structures and these economic crises. So everybody else laughed it off, but because I had a grounding in the Austrian business cycle theory, I saw immediately that there was some connections and some very strong connections. And so that's what my research was about. And I tried to publish it in some mainstream economics journals because I thought it was important enough and that I could reach out to Austrians in other venues. But when mainstream academic journals looked at it, they just rejected it out of hand because it didn't have any equations, didn't have any econometric estimates and things of that nature. If you try to measure skyscrapers econometrically, you're not going to get the right result. You've got to look for the record-setting skyscraper, not just the number of skyscrapers or the number of floors or whatever it happens to be. You have to be able to use Austrian theory of the business cycle with its emphasis on the structure of production and the fact that artificially low interest rates tend to push entrepreneurs into longer run, more roundabout production processes that ultimately are found to be unprofitable as the business cycle moves on through time. And then, of course, we find ourselves in a crisis with high unemployment, lots of bankruptcies, and so on. And so It was, you know, I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw this thing. You know, I just stared at it for probably a couple of hours, and then I immediately started looking at the business news media and how they were handling it. I said, you know, these guys have got it all wrong. This guy, Andrew Lawrence, has stumbled onto something that's very, very important. And it tells us a whole lot about not just the coincidence, but what's really going on in an economy that is facing artificially low interest rates from the central bank for an extended period of time. It always has to be, to get a record, the easy monetary policy, the easy credit policy of the central bank has to take place over a long period of time. And that's why we saw three record-setting skyscrapers at the end of the 1920s that ushered in the Great Depression. And then again, in the 1960s, you know, we had very low interest rates. We had a booming bubble economy. And so at the end of the 1960s, there were three record-setting skyscrapers, namely the Sears Tower and World Trade Tower 1 and World Trade Tower 2. And, of course, that ushered in the stagflation of the 1970s and early 80s when we were in and out of recession and we had high inflation at that time, too.
So it's like it's gotten to a point. It gets to a point where these projects are made, and there's no worry about profit because they don't have to worry about profit because the government is shelling out money, keeping interest rates low. So profit doesn't matter. It's about well, I'll tell you what. We'll talk more about what it's about in just a moment. The Angel Clark Show will return. More with Mark Thornton. I have on the line with me Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Mises.org is the website. And we're talking about this skyscraper index. And Mark, I want to thank you so much for sticking around. I really appreciate it. You used this term a lot in the last segment. You were talking about the business cycle, the Austrian business cycle. And is there any chance that you can kind of explain the Austrian version of the business cycle to us?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's not that difficult. There are some technical aspects that we don't need to cover. But basically, with the way Austrians view the economy, if we had a pure free market economy without a central bank, that what we would see is a very steady economy over time. And that the more we saved, the more we would grow. But there wouldn't be a cyclical activity where you see large amounts of unemployment, you know, and things of that nature. The Fed also causes price inflation, but their activities, more importantly, their activities cause the business cycle itself. Because once you add a central bank into a free market economy, you cause these kinds of distortions because the Federal Reserve influences interest rates in the economy. The, you know, typically you have people who saved who would lend money to people who invest.
Yeah.
And the market would determine that level of interest rates. But once you have the government central bank coming in and setting that level rather than the marketplace, that opens up the potential for distortions. And every economist knows that when the government puts either a price ceiling or a price floor on a particular market where the government is managing the range of prices that can emerge in a market, well, it inevitably leads to shortages and surpluses of products. It distorts the market. So you're getting the wrong signals sent to producers and the wrong signals sent to consumers. And so the Austrians apply this notion to the central bank and its setting of interest rates. And if the central bank just happened to set the same rate as the market, well, everything would be okay. The plans of savers and the plans of investors would match up just nicely with that interest rate. But what happens if the central bank errors and sets the rate that banks can charge and banks can borrow from the Fed at a rate below what the market would otherwise set? Well, two things, basically. That low interest rate encourages investors to invest more than they otherwise would, and it tells consumers as savers that you, with that lower interest rate, that you don't have to save as much. You know, the incentive to save is just not there. Like right now, with the Fed setting interest rates at zero, the interest rate you earn on your accounts is like 0.1%. So who has the incentive to save? So the Fed, instead of helping line up savings and investment, actually drives a wedge. You get more investment and more consumption. And so that's where you get the boom, because people are consuming more, investors are investing more, and everybody's just making money and having fun and buying speedboats and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And so that's where you get the boom in the economy. But of course, it doesn't sound right for the long run, right? Because eventually things are going to turn against all this, and people who, all those entrepreneurs who thought that they were going to make all these profits, you know, now what they start to face is their expenses, their costs of building their projects and of running their projects start to rise, because there's this ultra demand on all sorts of resources. And so their costs go up. And because so many people are investing in things like computer chips or houses or whatever, you know, there's much more of that coming onto the market than is typical or that would be required. And so the competition between those computer chip makers and those home builders gets much more intense, and the price of those chips and the price of those homes come down. And so, you know, if your costs are going up and the price that you're selling at it is going down, that wipes out your profit and probably sends a lot of those companies reeling into restructuring and into bankruptcy, homeowners into foreclosure. And so the Austrians see the problem as the central bank setting interest rates. They see the errors taking place in the boom phase of the cycle. That's where all these investments start. And the bust part of the business cycle, which is typically a, you know, nobody likes that. It's not pleasant. It's the problem that the mainstream economists are trying to solve with their stimulus packages and, you know, bailouts and things of that nature. That's where the Austrians see, we view the bust phase of the business cycle as the correction phase of the business cycle, where the resources that were misallocated now have to be reallocated. Their prices are falling and their owners are losing ownership, and they have to be turned over to new uses. And so the Austrian view of the business cycle is completely backwards and entirely different than mainstream economics. Mainstream economics sees the business cycle as a psychological phenomenon, or as some kind of weird natural phenomenon, like
the animal spirits, right? Like the animal spirits.
Like the animal spirits, yeah. You know, it gets investors and entrepreneurs all pumped up at one point, and, you know, they're drinking, they're partying. Remember the Hayek versus Keynes video?
Yes.
They're all drinking and partying. That's the bubble phase in the economy, where everybody's having a good time. And then the bust phase is when Keynes wakes up with a giant hangover, and the first thing he wants to do is take another slug of whiskey. And Hayek says, no, don't do that. You'd just be right up back on the binge, back on the binge train.
But
you don't want to do that.
Hasn't the Fed still, like, don't we still have artificially set interest rates, meaning that this hasn't exactly worked itself out yet?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the interest rates that the Fed manages is the money market federal funds rate in New York, where banks borrow and lend to each other. And basically the Fed is willing to lend these big New York City banks funds at 0.25%. So effectively they're zero. And so these big New York banks and other related entities can essentially get free loans.
Hold on to that thought, Mark. We have to step away for just a moment. The Angel Clark Show will return. More with Mark Thornton.
For all those looking to kick the habit of mommy and daddy governments, is the Angel Clark Show.
monopoly of force within a certain geographical area. That's what it is, a monopoly of force. I think that decent human beings want to minimize force. Therefore, you want to minimize
the state, the government, the supreme, the aggressor. Your trusted source for the liberty impaired. Angel Claw starts.
Welcome back to the Angel Clark Show. This is the final segment of the show today. It happens every Monday through Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. We always hit the last segment, and I know it's depressing for all of you. I know you don't want the show to end, but we must end sometime. I can only talk for so long. Only so long. But there is a solution. You can go to angelclark.us. There you can find over a year's worth of archives of the show. You can download them. You can stream them. You can share them with your friends. And most importantly, you can get more Angel Clark. Also, as usual, I did not get to talk about all the topics that I wanted to today. So go to my new website, noarmycanstopanidea.com. I want you to scroll down and click on the box that says show prep. And there you will find normally about 30 articles a day that I wanted to share with you, but I didn't get to because I got sidetracked talking about drunken Welsh accents and all kinds of things like that. Right. So now that being said, it is Thursday. It's the Liberty Train. Choo choo. And I have on the line with me Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, Mises.org. I highly recommend that you check it out if you haven't. And Mark has been kind enough to be to join us this evening. And he's been explaining a little bit about the skyscraper index and the boom and bust cycle. He mentioned a video in the last segment, and this video was done by, I believe the website is econstories.com. John Popola is the gentleman who helped to make this video. He's an awesome guy. He's been on the show before. And it's the Keynes versus Hayek, or Hayek versus Keynes. It's the boom and bust cycle. And it's this great series of rap videos, kind of, they kind of dumb down and explain a little bit about economics in a way that just really reached a lot of people. It touched a lot of people because it brought it to the cultural mainstream. Music is very important, and a lot of us connect with music. And so I really love those videos. If you haven't seen them, check it out. But Mark, I want to thank you so much for sticking around. And we were talking about these business cycles and the booms and the busts. And we had just mentioned the artificial interest rates that are still set super low. And basically these banks are getting free money, and it's going to end one of these days. It's going to stop. And so what do you think is going to be the result of this? And how is it that we can see this, right? We know that this is going to end sometime, and it's going to be horrible. And there's going to be this crazy bust, and people are going to go broke, and they're going to be depressed, and they're going to say, why didn't we see this? Well, we see this coming, right? So what do these people think is going to happen? Do they think unicorns are going to pop out of the sky and just crap golden rainbows? I mean, what do they think is going to happen?
It's a good question, Angel. The mainstream economists are totally blinded by this whole thing. And it goes all the way back to Irving Fisher in 1929, who said that we're going to have permanent prosperity, when at the same time you have Hayek and Mises warning of a Great Depression. And right up to the current, housing bubble, the Austrians were, writing about the housing bubble as early as 2003, and I started it in 2004, and we were making these warnings, we were making these calls, and Ben Bernanke said that, he's looked at the banking system and mortgage-backed securities, and he thinks they're all great, better run than ever. And, so they got it completely wrong. And what they're doing now is also completely wrong. They're controlling interest rates. They're trying to prop up certain businesses. They're providing stimulus spending in the economy. They're spending huge deficits into the economy. And these are precisely the things that prevent the economy from healing itself and getting us back on the road to growth. So where the mainstream economists advocate lowering the interest rate, Austrians advocate a free market interest rate where savers have the incentive to save and put resources aside so that entrepreneurs can use them. The mainstream people want to try to keep employment going and try to keep prices high, and that's the exact wrong thing to do. You want the economy to deflate from the bubble, you have to let prices fall And ultimately, that's going to mean that certain businesses, certain investments, certain projects are going to go bankrupt, and they're going to be forced onto the market at a very low price. But what that deflation does is it reduces capital prices, stock prices, investment good prices really low. It reduces labor costs, but consumer good prices don't fall very much because as consumers, we have to continue to consume food, clothing, and shelter, electricity, automobiles, etc. And so the deflation sets up the prospects whereby entrepreneurs can take this low-priced capital and this low-priced land and this low-priced labor, put it back into a package, organize it to produce consumer goods, and make a profit. So what the mainstream economists fear, this deflation, is actually the curative part of the business cycle. The falling prices create profit opportunities. And, you know, so the mainstream economists think that if we ever get into a deflation, that in and of itself is a bad thing. And they talk about if you go into a deflation, it's like a black hole. You get sucked in, you get destroyed, and you never come out of it. Whereas Austrians view this as a shock absorber, that yes, the economy falters initially and individuals go bankrupt and businesses go bankrupt, but it's that very process that restarts the economy. And, you know, so we've seen this in the past. We've seen this in the 19th century where panics turned into periods of growth. We saw this in the Great Depression of 1920. We've seen this in the business cycles since then. We've seen evidence in other countries of this deflationary restart. The only time that economies have not recovered has been the Great Depression, the situation over in Japan, and the current economic crisis. We should have been out of this crisis long ago. It should be a forgotten memory, basically, of the past. We should be back in growth, but the mainstream economic policies that have been followed are the exact wrong ones. So, you know, and that happened in the Great Depression, too. Hoover and FDR pursued stimulus packages, low interest rates, deficit spending, you know, and all those New Deal programs that Hoover initially put together himself. FDR dusted them off, renamed them, and put more money into them in an effort to keep prices high. And so they were doing things like killing pigs, plowing over crops to destroy production in order to keep prices high. I mean, just on the face of it, that just doesn't make any sense. But that's the same sort of logic that we're using today. You know, the stimulus effort, the deficit spending, the low interest rates, the bailouts, they are all absolutely the wrong approach. So it's not surprising to Austrians that in this environment, we still are in an economic crisis.
Yeah, but I mean, if we're talking about this this deflation that's going to happen and these companies going out of business, aren't a lot of people going to lose their jobs? I mean, the unemployment rate. We hear all these stories about the unemployment numbers, and they say, well, unemployment's getting better now, and so wouldn't that make it worse?
It would make it worse for a very short period of time. In a free market correction to central bank stimulus booms, typically the whole process of recovery takes place in less than 1 year. So, yes, it would be very painful for a large number of people, but you get recovery much, much more quicker. And, you know, this is no recovery at all. You know, the unemployment rate has come down from 10% to 7.3%, but nobody's happy about that. The number of people who are employed part-time is very high and growing because of Obamacare, and they're losing hours. And so if you look at the entire picture of employment, if you look at the fact that there's a lot of people working part-time that would rather work full-time, and a lot of service industry type people who have have much fewer clients coming to them, you see a very underemployed workforce. And if you look at the measure of unemployment that looks at all of these groups, it's about 14%. And if you look at right now, the largest number of people ever have been taken off of the employment rolls. So that number of 7.3% is totally misleading.
Mark Thornton, Mises.org, thank you so much.